Experts claim there is nothing tougher than a diamond. But at Diamonds Direct, we beg to differ. Have you ever met a mother? Strong, radiant, timeless. This Mother's Day, give her the gift that meets her match. With diamond jewelry starting at $200, plus Diamonds Direct's exceptional quality and unbeatable everyday price, you're sure to give her a gift that wows this generation and the next to come. Experience the thrill of jewelry shopping done right at Diamonds Direct. Diamonds Direct. Your love, our passion.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith, host of the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at the very least as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and I answer your phone calls and respond to your tweets. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions and straight-shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers, all that and more. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
Hi,
this is Ethnically Ambiguous,
episode 95.
This is Anna
and Shereen, and today is a very informative episode packed with things. What do we talk about first?
Well, you talk about the abortion laws going through the South right now that are some real trash.
Yeah, I also bring up what Gucci did to demonize Sikhs some more. Not demonize, but they made their religion into a accessory.
Yes, and then I talk about more information about what's going on between Iran and the U.S. and all the tensions are rising, and this episode is dedicated to my friend Domo.
Who are we? Where did we come from? Who do we become? What is it to be? What to be is it? Where are we? Who are my parents? Where are my pants? Why were we born? We are Ethnically Ambiguous.
Hello. Wow.
Hey.
Hi.
Is
that cool?
Yeah. This is episode 95. Is that right? I think it is. I think it's 95.
Yes.
I should probably double check. But I'm pretty sure we're still in the 90s. The best era ever. And because we were both born in the 90s, if you guys wanted to know how old we are. But this episode is jam-packed with information, so I'm probably going to get into it. But first off, there's something I want to talk about before I get started on mine, and there's also something that you want to talk about.
Yeah, so recently, and by recently, I mean like a few days ago, I learned that a friend of mine passed away from college. It's a good friend of mine. We spent a lot of time together. And it's an interesting thing because, you know, when death always brings people together, but it's always like so shitty because you like wish that person who you were, you know, thinking about was there. And I feel like something very interesting happened. Like, he was a gay black man and he, you know, he was out, I think, long before I started hanging out with him in college. I believe we met my sophomore year of college and then, you know, proceeded to be friends for a very long time. And I went recently through a, like, finding out he passed away was, like, very hard because he was one of those people that, like, really, really brought joy into every situation. Like, he was just a fun person. He was always there. He was always down to have fun, and he was always down to like be silly and joke around and laugh, and probably like one of my favorite people to hang out with while I was in college. And, you know, like, we always you know, we had a lot of classes together, and I remember one professor would not let us sit together because we were, like, always having too much fun during our classes. Like, we just couldn't focus when we were together. And then in between classes, we were, like, the photo booth queens. Like, we were always doing photo booth.
I remember those
on our
days.
Computers.
Yeah.
You know, if you have a Mac, photo booth.
Well, actually, I never had a Mac in college except for my like the end of my senior year. But I do remember I would use my friend's Mac's photo booth. So I understand by periphery.
I mean, it's a good time.
Yeah.
You know, just cheesing. But so like I find out Tuesday night and I, you know, Wednesday I wasn't really wanting to come into work. But like I knew we had Shangela here. Which, by the way, Shangela was on our podcast. It drops on this Wednesday.
Yeah.
Get excited.
We made it the priority guest episode because it's that fucking good.
Yeah. And I didn't really, you know, like, that's really the only reason I came in, because Shangela was going to be here. If it was any other person, I probably would have just slowly, like, dragged my body into work. But it was, like, so nice to be around this gay man who'd taken on drag culture and become like literally an all-star on RuPaul, if you've seen it, and just so happy and accepted and just living this great life. It was like very nice to see that, especially when my friend, you know, like he struggled to love himself and find himself, and it was a process, as we all do, because we're all constantly evolving, like we said before, to like find ourselves and see who we can really truly be in our full potential. And I did feel like my friend was coming around to that finally. And his life was cut short way too soon. And, you know, it's very devastating and heartbreaking to think about. But it was nice to see Shangela and her, like, very amazing, good energy, like, that was brought into the room. And it really helped brighten my day. And it was nice to see this man, like, having basically achieved all this amazing success and being, like, probably like one of the biggest fan favorites on the show.
Oh yeah, 100%. Shangela's been on the show more than any other contestant, and he's guested on other shows as well. But he's been on the show on 3 different seasons, and that's not counting the random guest episodes he's done in other seasons. So by like bar none, he's the favorite. And even my friend Adam, my best friend Adam, I texted him like, guess it's in my office, and I texted him the photo, and I mean, like, everyone I told like freaked the fuck out, and all the our stories are blowing up, being like, how'd you guys get Shangela? So I mean, I think when he came in as DJ Pierce, he wasn't dressed as Shangela, so I think I should call him he, but he has this energy that's so genuine and just truly pure. Like, he's just good. You can just tell he is good. And I'm so happy that someone who was good has gotten success and still getting success. And we can't wait to see where his road will take him. But I didn't know your friend that passed away as well as you did. I mean, I know him only like through being at the same university. But
yeah,
I mean, I'm glad you came in the office. And I think I'm glad that I feel like seeing this other gay man maybe made you feel like a certain like type of, I don't know, like I'm not sure. Like
it just made me feel better to see someone who like really made something out of their lives and
like thrived.
Thrived and like never felt judged and felt good about themselves.
Yeah.
And it really just reminded me of this friend of mine, and it made me feel good to like have this person, like, interact with this person the day after my friend passed away. And it was just, like, really good vibes to start my,
like,
morning off with, when I had, like, a night of just, like, complete, like, sadness. Talking to, like, friends and stuff and, like, reminiscing. It was,
I mean, that's why representation is so important, because seeing yourself, like, a version of yourself being happy and accepting themselves wholly and completely, I think that makes us feel like we can do it too. And I'm not saying everything would have changed if Shangela was in his life. That's not what I'm saying. But I'm saying these kinds of
his life would have changed if Shangela was there.
No, but I mean, it is important to acknowledge just how important representation is. And seeing yourself, whether it's on a television show or even just like in the public eye, but not only just to see yourself, but see that person be proud of all of their marginalized qualities. And so yeah, I can't wait for you guys to hear the Shangela episode. It's really, really good. So many good stories, and it's just a very open, honest time. So that's on Wednesday. Stay tuned.
Yeah. So that's coming out. But yeah, I just, you know, I want to talk a little about my friend, because he was a very important person in my life, and I'll miss him. I think we'll all miss him. Everyone who knew him will miss him. So shout out to Domo. I hope you rest easy. I hope it all finally made sense for you towards the end. And I hope you went out happy. That's what you always hope, that someone who, the minute they closed their eyes, at least maybe they were happy, even if it didn't, their eyes did not open ever again. So I love you, Domo. This episode is dedicated to Domo.
Okay.
So, okay, please go for what were you going to say?
I have a lot of, I wanted to dedicate the most of my time today to the abortion bill that came out in the U.S. I know we usually talk about Middle Eastern issues, but I think this is very disturbing what's going on in our like political landscape. So I want to touch on that. But before I do, my friend sent me something this morning that I can't not mention. So Gucci, like the brand Gucci, that just the name alone, you know what I'm talking about. They're under fire for selling a full, quote, indie turban, I-N-D-Y turban. Hmm. So this turban, Italian fashion brand Gucci, they're selling a pre-wrapped turban that was $800. And even though the piece has been since removed from all the websites that it was on, and it's been marked as sold out, and the price has been removed as well, the product was originally worn by white male models on the label's fall 2018 runway. So literally just like a couple months ago in 2018, white models were seen wearing these turbans that are extremely similar to Sikh turbans.
It's not cute.
And so it's been removed from circulation, yeah, since facing criticism from the Sikh community. In a statement to NBC News, the Sikh Coalition said of the product, the turban is not just a fashion accessory to monetize, but a religious article of faith that millions of Sikhs around the world view as sacred. A Sikh restaurateur and social media influencer, I'm sorry for the mispronunciation of this name, but Harjinder Singh Kurije said he also went viral after tweeting at the brand saying, "Dear Gucci, the Sikh turban is not a hot new accessory for white models, but an article of faith for practicing Sikhs. Your models have used turbans as, quote, hats, whereas practicing Sikhs tie them neatly fold by fold. Using fake Sikhs / turbans is worse than selling fake Gucci products." And this is after the brand Gucci, the same brand, has not learned from their mistakes, because they were slammed last February for selling a sweater that resembled blackface. Remember that? In the same fall 2018 collection, they were selling a sweater that resembled blackface. $900, knit top, had a large mouth cover with big red lips, and this evoked very racist historical stereotypes, because African Americans were often caricaturized in cartoons and propaganda this way. And in response, Gucci immediately removed the product online. But I just think, I mean, so Gucci did not respond to the request to comment from any news outlets that I read. But I just think it's absurd. And when you see this photo, it's just like, what? I don't know. So I think I'm a little annoyed, because they can't have not known the negative attention this would have gotten. Like, I think in their mind, they're thinking all press is good press. Even if it's bad press, at least like people are talking about us. But no, like I hope it's fucking Gucci. Like, shouldn't they know better? Shouldn't someone in that massive company have been like, this isn't okay? I don't know. So that was the one thing I wanted to mention before going into the shit show that is this abortion bill. Should I just get right into it?
Yeah, might as well.
Cool. But for those wondering about this photo, definitely look at our footnotes. I'll put the link. Fugucci is what I'm saying. Okay.
Fugucci.
Yeah, Fugucci. Last week, Alabama sent they sent the most restrictive abortion bill in the history of the country, in the recent history, to the governor's desk Tuesday night, so last Tuesday, with the state's Senate passing legislation that could punish doctors to perform abortions with life in prison. So this is before it was signed into action. So I'm just going to take you through a little bit of history of like the last, like, we're recording this on Thursday, so I compiled information for the last like 48 hours that have happened, because this has all happened fairly recently. So the state's Republican backers have pushed this legislation, which amounts to a near total ban on abortions in the state of Alabama, forward with the express goal of overturning Roe v. Wade, which is a Supreme Court case legalizing abortion. This bill would slap doctors with up to 99 years in prison for performing an abortion. And the Alabama House passed the bill earlier this month. So Republican Governor of Alabama, Kay Ivey, she has officially signed this legislation. And I'm going to get into her statement a little bit later, but I'm just going to go through the past couple of days of what has led up to this. And even though she has not publicly taken a stance on the bill, she has previously aligned herself as anti-abortion. And this bill comes after several states have passed fetal heartbeat bills. So in passing this most restrictive abortion bill, Alabama lawmakers joined legislators in several other states in putting forth legislation to restrict abortion, such as Georgia's recent fetal heartbeat bill. So the Georgia bill. Let's get into what that one was. Governor of Georgia, Brian Kemp.
Stolen governor.
He signed a bill 2 weeks ago that would ban abortions if a fetal heartbeat can be detected. This can happen as early as 6 weeks into pregnancy, when many women don't know that they're pregnant yet. So 6 weeks is basically like you're 2 weeks late. Many women don't know they're pregnant at this point. So the bill is very simple, but it's also very powerful. It's a declaration that all life has value. This is what Kemp is saying. That all life matters and that all life is worthy of protection. But it's not just Georgia and Alabama. Mississippi Governor Phil Bryant signed a bill into law in March that would ban abortions once a fetal heartbeat is detected as well. And Ohio Governor Mike DeWine signed a similar legislation in April.
So you're and having... You know what's fucked up about that Ohio one? There's what? A 13-year-old. Or 13 or 11-year-old, I forget exactly. 11-year-old who has to have this baby after she was raped.
Yep. Yeah, because that's the other thing. They don't... Rape and incest are not exceptions.
Yeah, unless the mother's life is in danger.
Yeah, which is...
So an 11-year-old has to have a baby?
Yeah.
Because they were, like, literally kidnapped, held in a closet, and raped by a pedophile.
So, yeah, it's really disturbing because rape and incest are not exceptions in any of these bills. And it's not just Alabama. Like, these are, like, I've listed, like, five states right now that are imposing this anti-abortion bill. And it's very, very detrimental. And I want you to, I mean, I'm not sure if we have any pro-life listeners out there, but I really want you to at least consider the idea to value the woman's life just as much as this unborn baby. Because, like, many times these bills are held up in committees and they end up being rejected in legislative votes or they're vetoed by governors, but no state has been able to put down this heartbeat bill into practice. So that's good, but the fact that it's getting so common is really worrisome to me. In January, so Iowa actually struck down this heartbeat bill, declaring that's unconstitutional. So thank you to this Iowa judge. And the U.S. Supreme Court has previously declined to weigh in after these bills, after the lower courts blocked the bills in North Dakota and Arkansas. So there are three exceptions to Alabama's near total abortion ban. Rape is not one of them. These are the following exceptions. One, to avoid a serious health risk to the unborn child's mother for ectopic pregnancy, which means like a dangerous pregnancy, essentially, or if the unborn child has a lethal anomaly. Also, just the fact that they're even saying it's a child, like, these exceptions that they're saying the unborn child. A cluster of cells is not a child. If it can't function outside of the womb, it's not a living thing.
There was a really good reductionist post that said, Senator says the only acceptable way to kill a fetus is with a gun. Just thought that would
That's
stupid.
The same people that, I mean, I'm going to get into this a little bit later, but the same people that are pro-abortion are usually, not pro-abortion, but pro-life, are usually ones that are also pro-gun, because those conservative values usually line up, which is something I'm going to get into a little bit later. But Democrats had reintroduced an amendment to exempt rape and incest victims, but this motion failed on 11-21 vote. That's half, so half of these fucking people that were voting said rape and incest victims should not be allowed to have abortions. That's, like, why? Like, it made
me tickled my nose.
That just makes me enraged. Your nose, I mean. Mm-hmm. But so Alabama's abortion bill is setting up a fight over Roe v. Wade, and this was the point of this bill all along. This is what the people that put forth the bill were indicating that they wanted to achieve. They wanted to overturn Roe v. Wade. But fortunately, a Supreme Court hearing could be years away. But this is still extremely important to understand. So just a little bit of history about Roe v. Wade. 1973, it was a landmark decision of the U.S. Supreme Court in which the court ruled that abortion was legal, and it provides a fundamental right to privacy. This amendment provides a fundamental right to privacy that protects a pregnant woman's liberty to choose whether or not to have an abortion, while also ruling that this right is not absolute and must be balanced against the government's interest in protecting women's health and protecting prenatal life. So what it's saying is that women have the right to choose, but it also has to align with the state's rules. So that's why all these states are coming forth with their own legislations, because they're getting this loophole in Roe v. Wade. But Roe v. Wade is so important because it's a huge part of women's rights and women equality. And so overturning it, or even trying to, is extremely disturbing. And the fact that they've gone this far makes me scared.
It is, you do want to make it clear that abortion is legal because it's on a federal level, it's legal.
On a federal level, it's legal, but even in this clause in the 14th Amendment, which is what Roe v. Wade is, it says it has to line up with the state's
right. The good thing is that the ACLU will sue. I believe they are working on suing right now to block this and then overturn these bills.
Yeah, both the ACLU.
The only problem is if it gets to the Supreme Court. We are fucked because damn dudes don't give a shit about women.
Yeah, it's a little bit.
Cava loser.
Yeah. With Kavanaugh in power, I have very small hope. But so both the ACLU and Planned Parenthood are both suing, which is great because they're not letting this go without a fight. And this, they only decided to sue, I think, officially after Governor Ivey of Alabama officially signed this into action. So what's absurd to me is that 57% of voters think that Roe v. Wade should stay in place, which is what a recent poll says. This is, okay, 57% is the majority, but it's way too low. That's way too low for a national vote. 57% is not high enough for the public to respect women enough to have them make their own choice about their bodies. I'm going to get into a little bit more about this bill and what people are saying about it after a quick commercial break, so stay put.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turned sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith. When I'm not at my day job, First Take, you can find me in my studio hosting the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, at the very least, as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and politics. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions on those nauseating Cowboy fans, the chaos in Washington, D.C., and trending topics on social media, as well as my straight shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers. And I occasionally give out love advice. Yes, it's true. If you want to know my true feelings about something, I'll give it to you straight. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
Hey, I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go, right? There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. On NPR's new podcast, Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's part existential deep dive and part game show. I ask actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to ask some of life's biggest questions. Listen to NPR's Wildcard on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, and I'm back. We're back. All by myself. Okay, so as I was talking about this here.
Okay. Weirdo.
Alabama State Senator Bobby Singleton, he's a Democrat, and he told CNN that this abortion bill is horrible. He says, "I think we raped women last night. We made women of Alabama the model of the new Roe v. Wade. This is a horrible bill." And he's talking to the people that voted this into action. He says, "Is that your intent, to send doctors to jail for 99 years for even an attempted abortion, and up to 10 years in prison for an attempt, not even defining what an attempt is?" And then he said, "But they just look at me in the eyes and stare as if, yes, that's what I want to do." He was referring to the part of the bill that would slap doctors with up to 99 years in prison, as I said, for performing an abortion. So this is also 99 years of prison is a higher sentence than a rapist would get, FYI, which is disgusting. Kamala Harris, she said that the Alabama lawmakers need to check their hypocrisy. When she was speaking to a crowd in New Hampshire, she criticized Alabama lawmakers for their stances on healthcare and abortion, saying that, "I will also say, on this day where we saw what happened in Alabama, let us all agree that women's healthcare is under attack. We will not stand for it. We will not stand for it." So a lot of politicians and celebrities have come forward with outrage about this bill because it is outrageous and disgusting, and I hate it so much. She went on to say that the idea that as supposed leaders have passed into law something that would criminalize a physician for assisting a woman on something that she, in consult with her physician, with her God, with her faith leader, has made a decision to do, that it's her body that you would criminalize and say for up to 99 years, which is a life sentence. And this is the same state, the same kind of people who also stand in the way of what women need in terms of a ban on existing conditions to have access to issues like prenatal care. These lawmakers need to check their hypocrisy. So I'm thankful for the politicians that are coming out and staying clear in their beliefs and their stances. So Planned Parenthood Southeast says that lawmakers are playing political games with women's lives. Stacey Fox, who's the president and CEO of Planned Parenthood Southeast Advocates, say that lawmakers are looking out for their own movement and not the lives of the women they voted against last night. They made a statement before they decided to sue, they said the lawmakers are playing political games with women's lives like Georgia, Alabama, and Mississippi. They have been blatant and overt over that. They know and publicly say that these laws are unconstitutional, and they don't care. They don't care about money they're wasting. They don't care about the lives they are risking. All they care about is getting attention in their own movement, in their own elections next fall. We aren't playing games. We are focused on the patients who need access to health care. We also are laser focused on making sure that those who voted against women's lives don't return to work next fall. So fuck yeah, Planned Parenthood. Yeah. You're fucking G. Someone I really want to highlight right now. Senator Vivian Davis figures, who was one of six Democrats who voted no on the bill. She debated Republican Senator Clyde Chambliss on the Senate floor last week. And Clyde Chambliss is one of the main advocates for this bill and the person that even, one of the people that brought it forth. She says to him, "Do you know what it's like to be raped? Do you know what it's like to have a relative commit incest on you?" Chambliss eventually responded no to both questions. And this is after Democrats had introduced this amendment to exempt rape and incest victims from a near total abortion ban, and then this motion failed. So she asked him this after that happened. She continued, "You don't have to raise that child. You don't have to carry that child. You don't have to provide for that child. You don't have to do anything for that child, but yet you ought to make a decision for that woman, and that's what she has to do." And then he responded with, "I want to make a decision for that child." So just they're
what an idiot.
Pro-life people are all about what about the life of this unborn baby? What if it cures cancer? Well, what if that mom doesn't have a kid and goes on to cure cancer? Like, what about the life of this mother that didn't choose to be a mother? You're denying a life for a life, which is not you're essentially playing a sick game of control and God. And I, like, if it's not your body, you have no right to control it. So, exactly. I also, huh?
Exactly.
Yeah. Senator Bernie Sanders, who, like 20 other people, is running for president in 2020. He called Alabama state senators who voted to pass this bill hypocrites. He said they decry big government and yet they want to control every aspect of a woman's body, her private decisions, and their future. Our job is to fight at every step to protect reproductive rights. Thank you, Bern. An Alabama Democrat suggested that Democrats need to create a castration bill. She said, you make the choice about your health care. You go out and get your own health insurance. Well, why shouldn't I also make the choice about your body? It wasn't very long ago that we started talking about the rights of women. Maybe we need to come up with a castration bill. I mean, you guys sure come up with some crazy bills. And then she said that, and then she was cheered. She even suggested that they would like to open up Republicans' minds to see what's inside and suggested that they speak to their mothers.
Mm.
She said, I know God made women different. He really did. You all came from a woman. Did you not get anything from her? If you have a mother and she's still alive, deep down she would tell you this is not right. You're shaking your head, but I bet she would. So, fuck yeah. This is Senator Linda Coleman Madison, an Alabama Democrat. So, thank you. So, there are good people in...
These dudes are monsters.
What?
I said these dudes are monsters.
Yeah. And if you look at the picture, there's a photo that's like circulating social media of the people that pass it into mm-hmm. action. All of them, old white men. Like, none of them have any idea what it's like to be a mother or, like, the possibility of being a mother. They're just, like, old white men should not have any say in women's rights and women's productive health. It makes me absurdly mad. And it made me think, like, you know, vasectomies are reversible. So if you guys really want to do something about like, birth control, how about guys get, like, mandatory vasectomies and then you can reverse them when it's time to have a child, you know? Like, why is it on us? Anyway, that's just a question. Thought. I want to play this clip really quick. Planned Parenthood talked to CNN, and this is just a little excerpt they were saying about how the future for women's health is dangerous under Trump. So, a quick clip.
We have a president of the United States who willfully lies to the American people to score political points and to provide political cover for politicians who are passing extreme anti-women's health bills. With Trump in the White House and Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court, women's health and rights are under assault like never before. At Planned Parenthood, we will do whatever it takes to stop these dangerous bans so that our patients can continue to access the care they need. We are in the fight of our lives, for our patients' lives, and we are ready to fight with everything we have.
That was Dr. Leanna Wen, who is the president of Planned Parenthood Action Fund. And so that was in a press conference yesterday, which is last Wednesday for you guys. So, yeah, Planned Parenthood is not backing down. Neither is the ACLU. As I said, a bunch of House Democrats have reacted to the abortion bill and how it was disgraceful and reckless. Representative Catherine Clark, who is the vice chair of the Democratic caucus, she called the action reckless behavior. She says, we are not going back. Women in this country are not going to allow our fundamental rights to be infringed upon. Meanwhile, in Ohio, the ACLU also sues over the state's heartbeat bill. So the heartbeat bill I mentioned earlier, the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union of Ohio, they're suing against, they filed a lawsuit to block this so-called heartbeat bill, which bans abortions after a fetal heartbeat is detected before it takes effect. So the law will take effect very soon, less than 2 months, and on July 10th, which is terrifying. Elizabeth Watson, who's a staff attorney for the ACLU Reproductive Freedom Project, she described the bill as blatantly unconstitutional, which is completely correct under Roe v. Wade, and just said the right to abortion is under unprecedented attack despite, quote, strong public support for supportive, affordable, and barrier-free access to abortion care. And she said the six-week abortion ban that Ohio legislature has passed is just the culmination of this long-standing all-out assault on women in Ohio. And many celebrities, I want to talk about some people that are speaking up about this. It's brought up a lot of personal stories from celebrities about abortions, like Mila Djokovic, is that how you say her name? Like the Fifth Element.
Yeah, I guess.
Actress. She talked about her abortion publicly. Busy Phillips talked about her abortion publicly. So normalizing this talk about abortion, I think, is so important because it's something that not just someone does out of, like, no woman wants to have an abortion. It's a decision made with a lot of thought, a lot of care, and ultimately it's her decision because having a baby when you're not ready is not good for either party. So Lady Gaga, she voiced her outrage over the Alabama abortion bill, and she expressed that, like, the outrage especially because it excludes victims of rape or incest, and it punishes doctors with harsher penalties than their rapist. She said in a post, "It is an outrage to ban abortion in Alabama, period, and all the more heinous that it excludes those who have been raped or are experiencing incest, non-consensual or not." So there's a higher penalty for doctors who perform these operations than most of the rapists. This is a travesty, and I pray for all these women and young girls who will suffer at the hands of the system. And she used the hashtag no uterus, no opinion, which I agree with. So late on Tuesday evening of last week, the Alabama governor Kay Ivey did sign this bill into law. It's not going into law going into effect immediately because it's getting sued and it doesn't just happen overnight. But the fact that it's getting signed into law is really troubling. And I want to read a little bit of her statement because it's infuriating to me. She said, "Today I signed into law the Alabama Human Life Protection Act, a bill that was approved by overwhelming majorities in both chambers of the legislature." She's a Republican, and she said, she continued, "To the bill's main supporters, legislation stands as a powerful statement and testament to Alabamians' deeply held belief that every life is precious and every life is a sacred gift from God." The Alabama Senate passed this bill 25-6 late Tuesday night. The law only allows exceptions for the following that I already mentioned: the health risk to the child's mother, an ectopic pregnancy, or if the child has a lethal anomaly. And then the amendment to exempt rape and incest victims was denied. She says, to all people of Alabama, "I assure you that we will continue to follow the rule of law. In all meaningful respects, this bill closely resembles an abortion ban that has been part of Alabama law for well over 100 years. As today's bill itself recognizes that longstanding abortion law has been rendered unenforceable as a result of the U.S. Supreme Court decision Roe v. Wade, I can't go into action right away." So she recognizes that this bill is unconstitutional, essentially. She says, "No matter one's personal opinion or view on abortion, we can all recognize that, at least for a short term, this bill may be similarly unenforceable. As citizens of this great country, we must respect the authority of the U.S. Supreme Court, even when we disagree with their decisions. Many Americans, including myself, disagreed when Roe v. Wade was handed down in 1973. The sponsors of this bill believe this is the time, once again, for the U.S. Supreme Court to revisit the important matter of Roe v. Wade, and they believe that this act may bring about the best opportunity for this to occur." So she's saying the people that brought this forward and herself want to overturn Roe v. Wade, and that was the whole point of this bill. And then she went on to thank, like, the people that sponsor the bill and all this bullshit. But I want to end by saying I hate her, and also that the fact that Planned Parenthood and the ACLU are suing, it's a good thing, because the reality is the law won't go into effect exactly tomorrow or, like, immediately, but the fact that it got this far really disturbs me, and it should disturb you too. Stacey Fox, again, the president and CEO of Planned Parenthood Southeast, said the organization will take Alabama's new anti-abortion law to court. In a statement, Fox said, "We vowed to fight this dangerous abortion ban every step of the way, and we meant what we said. We haven't lost a case in Alabama yet, and we don't plan to start now. We will see Governor Ivey in court. In the meantime, abortion is still safe, legal, and available in the state of Alabama, and we plan to keep it that way." And as I mentioned, like, one of the major pro-gun arguments is that people say making guns illegal won't stop people from getting guns. Like, why doesn't this argument apply to abortions? Because making abortions legal won't stop women from getting abortions. It just stops women from getting abortions safely. It's the same idea. The same people that are pro-gun, usually, not all the time, like, not across the board, but the conservative view of pro-gun usually aligns with pro-life. But the argument that making them illegal won't stop people from getting them is the same with abortions. It just makes it less safe for women to access them. And, like, how can you show more concern for the children living? Like, something that I really loved, I saw this tweet that was saying, to the conservative, like, masses, like, how can you show more concern for an unborn child than you do for the children living on the streets, stuck in foster care, and to all the immigrant children still separated from their parents? Like, these children are already born and suffering, and you're showing more care for nothing. Like, it's nothing. And there's this other tweet I want to end on. This guy, he's from India. And he said, "In India, abortions are legal. We have gun control. Women's sanitary products are exempted from taxes, and it's legal to be gay. Marriage isn't legal yet, but we're working on it," he says. Yet last week, this girl, who's American, commented on a post saying, "We are backwards." So, just want to remind you that America has this false identity of being progressive and the leader of the world, but it is so backwards. And it makes other countries feel inferior because of, like, I don't know, fucking, like, democracy or some shit, but that's not the case. Like, this president has made a step backwards so much, it disturbs me, and I just wanted a good amount of time to talk about that. So I hope that made sense. I know I'm, like, fumbling through my stuff today, but I think I had too much caffeine. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I thought so. I mean, it's pretty clear cut. These Sophie men are trying to run women's lives.
Yeah. So all my links will be in the footnotes and in the description of the episode when you click on it or whatever. So that was that.
Wow.
Pro-choice, obviously.
I'm pro-life, and I'm just joking. After all that, I reveal I'm actually anti-abortion. Let's take a quick break before
jumping.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith. When I'm not at my day job, First Take, you can find me in my studio hosting the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, at the very least, as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and politics. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions on those nauseating Cowboy fans, the chaos in Washington, D.C., and trending topics on social media, as well as my straight shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers. and I occasionally give out love advice. Yes, it's true. If you want to know my true feelings about something, I'll give it to you straight. So, listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go, right? There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. On NPR's new podcast, Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's part existential deep dive and part game show. I ask actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to ask some of life's biggest questions. Listen to NPR's Wildcard on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back. I kind of wanted to go deeper into the Iran news because that is what's on my mind. So last week we spoke about the nuclear deal and what's going on with all the tensions between Iran and the U.S. Mostly just the Trump administration, it seems like. But yeah, I wanted to go over a few more things because more stuff has happened in the last week that's just fucking crazy. Okay. So many things are very, like, a lot of events happened and it's very unclear what the details are. In the Gulf over the past few days, Iran-backed rebels, Houthi rebels, attacked the Saudi oil pipeline with drones. There was like a weird puzzling raid on oil tankers off the coast of the United Arab Emirates. And yeah, and then there was some saber rattling between Washington and Tehran as U.S. warships headed to the region. So, this is going to be a lot of information, but I hope you guys take it in easily. So, facts have started emerging about those things I just mentioned, those acts or events that just happened. So apparently there's apparent acts of sabotage. There's analysts on the oil-rich region that warned about deepening tensions between the U.S., its Gulf allies, and Iran. And a lot of this all kind of, all this talk was how this could all be coming to a head. Eckhart Wurtz, who's an expert on Gulf security and energy markets at the Barcelona Center for International Affairs, he told Al Jazeera, there are more questions than answers right now, but it's not looking good. The attack on the tankers and the oil pipeline must be viewed against the backdrop of a U.S. military buildup in the Gulf and worsening relations with Iran since the U.S. unilaterally pulled out of the 2015 nuclear deal. And of course, you know, tensions have been high between the U.S. and Iran after, you know, that the U.S. pulled out of the nuclear deal. And then, you know, Washington decided to try and cut Iran's oil exports down to zero. And then, you know, they sent a U.S. aircraft carrier to the Gulf in response to an unspecified threat from Iran. Wurtz went on to say, I don't expect to see a full-scale land invasion, but I'm watching for military escalations by the U.S. or Iranian proxies in Iraq and any other strikes on oil facilities that prove more effective and actually disrupt the flow of oil. So on Tuesday last week, Saudi Arabia said armed drones struck two of its oil pumping stations on the east-west petroline pipeline in an apparent long-range attack by Yemen's Houthi rebels, which is about some 320 kilometers west of the capital, Riyadh. The state-run oil company Aramco, they temporarily shut down the pipeline, which had suffered minor damage from the firings from the drones. But apparently the event sent crude prices up to 1.4% and settling at more than $71 a barrel. So that kind of fucked with the price of oil and the flow. So Houthi rebels in the neighboring Yemen claimed responsibility for the hit, but they've been fighting Saudi-led military coalitions in Yemen since 2015. So they're like believed to have received drones, ballistic missiles, and other arms from Iran, which is according to United Nations reports. That's been a thing for a while. The drone attack came 2 days after an apparent act of sabotage on two Saudi oil tankers, an Emirati vessel, and a Norwegian-registered oil product tanker that were bunkering close to Fujairah, which is in the UAE and in the Strait of Hormuz. So the UAE has not blamed anyone for the attack. U.S. national security agencies have pointed fingers at Iran, the Houthis, and other Iranian proxies, but have not offered any conclusive proof on who it could be. Iran denied involvement. On Wednesday last week, U.N. spokeswoman Stephane Dujarric, no, maybe it's a spokesman, Stephane Dujarric, condemned both attacks and called for an investigation to determine the facts behind the tanker sabotage and to figure out who's responsible for the attacks and, like, you know, hold them accountable. Dujarric also warned of hardening rhetoric in the region. In an email to Al Jazeera, it's a spokeswoman. Okay, that was confusing. Stephane. The spokeswoman for Britain's Foreign Office warned of the risk of unintended escalation in a volatile region and cautioned Tehran against taking any escalatory steps. Analysts told Al Jazeera the attacks underline the vulnerabilities of regional powers, Saudi Arabia and the UAE. So both governments, they've, you know, sought to open alternative oil export routes that avoid the Strait of Hormuz, because that Strait of Hormuz, which is like where 1/5 of the global oil passes, is like a trade zone that's for the most part run by Iran. And so it's very vulnerable to disruptions by Iranians, the country of Iran. Not Iranians in general, but, you know, the government. So Jim Crane, who's the author of Energy Kingdoms and a research analysis on the Gulf at Rice University, he said the attacks appear to have deliberately targeted oil transit routes that Saudi Arabia and the UAE established in the Strait of Hormuz. And so he goes on to say, whoever is behind these attacks seems to be signaling that no country's oil exports are safe. So that's where we're at with oil, because Iran's like, if you gonna fuck us up, we gonna fuck everyone else up.
Yeah.
So, you know, of course, Trump pulled out of the 2015 nuclear deal. And then last year, they sharply increased economic sanctions on Iran. And so under the 2015 accord, you know, Tehran was supposed to limit its nuclear activity for sanctions relief. So, you know, it's a complete turnaround. So now they're like in this other position, which is, you know, causing a lot of issues. So meanwhile, the U.S. provides military and logistical support to its allies, which is Saudi Arabia and the UAE, for their war in Yemen, which is against the Iran-backed Houthis and in support of the government of President Abd Rabu Mansour Hadi. So it's interesting how, like, we're all against each other in all these different countries. It's actually kind of unnecessary. We all need to pull out of these countries and stop killing people. Some analysts who spoke to Al Jazeera feel the Trump administration is acting recklessly. Jonathan Crystal, an expert on Gulf security at Adelphi University, accused Washington of smoke and mirrors tactic. He goes on to say, is there a threat from Iran? Sure, but that's a constant. Houthi activity against Saudi is not new. So while this does not excuse Iranian activity, it is, again, the Trump administration's reframing the routine as shocking and new. Sanjeev Berry, director of Freedom Forward, which campaigns for Washington to cut ties with foreign autocrats, said the deepening tensions were a wake-up call for Washington about how to pick friends in the Gulf. Another U.S. war in the Middle East would be catastrophic for the region, and the Trump administration needs to put a leash on National Security Advisor John Bolton, the biggest advocate for conflict with that no smart policymaker wants. That's, I mean, I feel like we cannot, you know, stress that enough.
No, put a fucking leash on him.
Fucking hawks in the administrations. Their names are Pompeo and Bolton. They're both fucking Muppets, and they're fucking trying to get us in a war. Barry goes on to say, instead of hyperventilating about Iran, the U.S. should cut ties with allies like Saudi and UAE, which fuel instability across the region with a bloody war in Yemen and support for military thugs in Libya and Sudan. God, it's so crazy how we're connected to all this murder. Anyway, so the Trump administration's claim that the threat of an attack by the Iranian regime on U.S. targets in the Middle East is increasing has been disputed by allies in Europe. On Wednesday last week, Department of State ordered all non-emergency government employees to leave its embassy in Baghdad and its consulate in Erbil and advised Americans against traveling to Iraq. Earlier this month, National Security Advisor John Bolton said the U.S. was preparing for possible attacks by Iran or its proxies. However, the British deputy commander in the Global Coalition Against Islamic State group contradicted the risk of an attack. Major General Chris Gicca, he told reporters on Wednesday last week, there has been no increased threat from Iranian-backed forces in Iraq or Syria. We're aware of their presence clearly, and we monitor them, along with a whole range of others, because that's the environment we're in. Gika said that the anti-ISIS task force had no intention to change protection measures or its escalation processes despite the developments in the Persian Gulf this week. He goes on to say, there are a substantial number of militia groups in Iraq and Syria, and we don't see any increased threat from many of them at this stage. Also, NBC News asked the British Ministry of Defense on Thursday last week whether it would raise the threat level for UK forces and diplomats in Iraq. The spokesperson said that the ministry has long been clear about our concerns over Iran's destabilizing behavior in the region, but that the security of personnel and assets is under constant review. So they were like, we're not going to be drawn onto that question, but we're constantly watching what's going on. Germany's foreign minister Heiko Maas also said Wednesday last week that he made it clear to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in a meeting earlier this week that a unilateral strategy of increasing pressure against Iran was ill-advised. He goes on to say maximum pressure always carries the risk of an unintended escalation. If you take a look at what other hotspots and sources of conflict are there in the region, then we certainly do not need one thing at the moment, an additional fuse. Sanam Vakil, that's funny because Vakil in Farsi means lawyer. But anyway, Sanam Vakil is a senior research fellow for the Middle East North Africa program at the London think tank Chatham House, claims while Europe opts for a more cautious approach in engaging the Iranian regime, in part due to its close proximity to the Middle East, the U.S. has adopted a strategy of fear-mongering and posturing. She goes on to say, Europeans ultimately believe the Trump administration has manufactured a crisis, and this crisis has prevented them from addressing the other equally important issues that impact European security. So the current situation stems from the U.S. withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal, and adding that the deal was working and Iran was in compliance. So now we're in this situation. It's all literally because of Trump.
Yep.
This is all just one giant escalation because of Trump. So the intelligence that caused the White House to escalate its warnings about a threat from Iran came from photographs of missiles on small boats in the Persian Gulf that were put on board by Iranian paramilitary forces. And that's according to three American officials. So overhead imagery showed fully assembled missiles stroking fears that the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps would fire them at United States naval ships. Additional pieces of intelligence picked up that threats against the commercial shipping and potential attacks by Arab militias with Iran ties and American troops in Iraq. Ugh. But now, how alarmed the Trump administration should be over the new intelligence is like a subject to a very intense debate amongst the White House, the Pentagon, the CIA, and American allies. So everyone's kind of arguing of like, what do these photos fucking mean? The photographs presented a different kind of threat than previously seen from Iran, according to three officials who spoke on the condition of anonymity because anonymity?
Anonymously,
whatever. Who spoke on the condition of anonymously because they were not authorized to talk about it publicly.
Anonymity.
There we go. That's how we do it here. So, taken with other intelligence, the photographs could indicate that Iran is preparing to attack United States forces. And, of course, that is the view of John Bolton, you know, our wonderful hardline national security advisor. And, of course, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is back there as well. So other officials, though, including Europeans, Iraqis, members of both parties in Congress, some senior officials within the Trump administration, said that Iran's moves might mostly be defensive against what Tehran believes are provocative acts by Washington. Either way, the questions about the underlying intelligence and the complaints by lawmakers that they had not been briefed on it reflect a deep mistrust of Mr. Trump's national security team. So working off of new intelligence, the State Department on Wednesday ordered a partial evacuation of the United States Embassy, I said that earlier, in Baghdad and a consulate in Iraqi Kurdistan, a move that one senior American official said was an overreaction to the intelligence and could possibly do more to endanger diplomats than keep them safe. So anyway, Speaker Nancy Pelosi, in a closed-door meeting of the House Democrats, criticized the administration's lack of transparency on the intelligence. She said that the administration must consult with Congress before taking any action. So let's fucking hope they understand that, because it doesn't seem like maybe they understand how, like, Congress works. But
Military officials, they struggled to show that the threat from Iran was growing, and intelligence officials declassified a photograph of one of the small boats called Dehaus carrying what was described as a functional Iranian missile. Pentagon did not release the photograph. On its own, two American officials said the photograph was not compelling enough to convince the American public and lawmakers or foreign allies of the new Iranian threat, but releasing other supporting images could compromise secret sources and methods of collecting intelligence. That's apparently why the Pentagon didn't release it, but... So other photographs which remain classified show the Revolutionary Guards loading missiles into boats at several Iranian ports, the two American officials said. It is believed that the boats are under the Revolutionary Guards' control, which, as you guys know, the government classified as a terrorist organization, which who fucking even knows. So in a sign of rising tensions over the handling of the Iranian threat, Senator Chuck Schumer of New York, the Democratic leader, said flaws in the Trump administration's approach were evidenced in an article by the New York Times that reported that the Pentagon plans for sending as many as 120,000 troops to the Middle East if hostilities with Iran escalated. Now, of course, Trump went on and denied this. So I don't know what the fuck is going on. All I know is that nobody is being very transparent, and I think it's because all their goddamn intel is trash and they're all a bunch of fucking idiots. And this all wouldn't have happened if you just read what the nuclear deal included and actually, like, read what the Atomic Energy Agency, whatever they're called, the IAEA, was writing. Like, they were reporting, they were in there checking shit out, and I guess Trump doesn't know how to read. So this is where we're at now. You're going to start a war, even though Trump himself said he does not want to start a war with Iran. So it's like, fool, then don't fucking start a war with Iran. Like, stop doing what you're doing.
Yeah, they're like, wait, what do we do? Did we do that?
Anyway, and they don't even seem to think, they think like Iran would be like war with Iraq. No. War with Iran would be nothing like war with Iraq. First of all, you couldn't handle war with Iran. Also, you would have ruined the region of the Middle East if you started a war with Iran. Think about it. Who's one of Iran's allies? Syria. You really want to fuck with Bashar al-Assad? The man has showed
he's a that monster.
He don't not give a shit about human life. He don't give a shit about anyone. You would get us all killed. You do not want Bashar al-Assad backing Iran. Also, who even fucking knows what's going to happen? Like, what do you think Russia's going to do? You do not want Russia involved. Russia is obsessed with the Middle East. Yep. If you get Russia involved in a war in the Middle East, we are all going to die. Putin is crazy.
That's honestly what Russia wants. Russia wants the power to sway the Middle East to its favor.
Also, you think Saudi Arabia wants a war next door?
No.
That's going to... Who do you think Iran's going to fucking go with? And then what happens when Iran decides that Israel should be a target because Israel's a fucking ally of the U.S.? What do you think is going to happen there? You think Israel's going to be like, okay. No, Israel's going to come out here with straight up nuclear weapons that we know they have. Okay.
100% because they're funded by the fucking U.S.
Like, literally, it's a domino effect. You fuck with one person, they go and fuck with your ally. That ally's going to fuck with this ally. And the next thing you know, we're in a goddamn world war. Okay. Like, this is...
Like,
horrible.
Why do you think Russia and Bashar al-Assad are like buddy-buddy? This is like their plan.
This is the most dangerous escalation you can fucking think of, because this will kill us all.
It will.
Iran is... they're just not playing. To be clear, Iran is not the one. They are not the one. Because you can't... First of all, even if you thought you could get in there and like fight a war on the grounds, Iran is all mountains, motherfucker. You ain't mountain people. Iranians are mountain people.
Yeah.
They will hide in those mountains for 10 weeks. Waiting for you to fucking walk out, and then they will kill you. And I'm not saying because Iranians are insane. I'm just saying this is a war we cannot fight. We don't want to fight this war. This isn't worth it.
It's also like sports, okay? Home games have the advantage. Same fucking idea. They went to fucking the middle of the fucking Middle East with Iraq or Afghanistan or whatever. They don't know what the fuck they're doing because they're in the middle of someone else's territory. It's not going to end up well.
It's just not going to work because it's not going to work. Like, it's not
sports analogy.
That's great.
Thank you.
This is how mass death of innocents happen.
Yeah.
This is too dangerous. These are not... We are not... Okay, first of all, you don't want to upset US. You don't want to upset Russia. You don't want to upset Iran. You don't want to upset Israel. You don't want to upset Saudi Arabia. Like...
Wow, sounds like some very powerful people. Nobody should be getting upset because the second every single one of those countries I just named gets upset, we're all going to die.
Especially with this fucking legislation and fucking leadership.
So, you know, as I said last week, Trump was like, call me. No big deal. Call me. We'll talk this out. Iran doesn't want to talk to Trump.
No one wants it. Like,
the foreign minister, Javad Zarif, came out and said, we are not here to have discussions with you. And it's because they don't want to talk with Trump. And they basically, no discussions are going to happen with Trump unless Trump is out of office or Trump literally says, okay, my bad. You guys can have whatever you want, which is, you know, of course, going to lead to Iran getting a nuclear program again because they've ruined everything.
They've left them with no choice but to retaliate have resentment.
And honestly, I believe this is all just men posturing each other. Like, yeah. They're just like posturing, like, no, I'm the tough guy. No, I'm the tough guy. And it's like, no, you're all fucking pussies. You're all dicks to small. Y'all got small dicks.
Okay, there's nothing bad with having a small dick. I don't like when you make that they can't control their dick size. That's not something they can change. But
what you need to understand is historically, men who have smaller dicks who are pieces of shit will act out of aggression because of that. That's just facts.
I feel like you made that up.
No.
Wait, that's a
real
fact?
Yeah. Dudes, have you never experienced this? That dudes just tend to have more anger if they're like, feel like they, and that's not all dudes.
I thought it was just like overcompensating. Like, that's a joke. Like,
no, that's not a joke. That joke came from somewhere.
A guy in the big truck must have a small wiener. Like, I thought that was like a joke.
Usually that sort of aggression comes from not being able to love yourself.
That's kind of sad.
Yeah. I mean, we all have it. Sometimes when I'm acting out, it's because I'm, you know, upset with something in my own life. It's all, it's acting out because you don't feel like you yourself are enough, no matter if you see it as having a small penis, or maybe I see it as having, like, big hips or something. Like, it's all the same. We're acting out because we're unhappy with ourselves. Yeah. And that is the deep down issue. I don't care if you have a small
penis.
But it's terrifying
when it comes to men in power, have power.
Yeah. Having a small penis, I don't care if you have a small penis. I'm just saying, as an analogy, they are unhappy with themselves.
Yeah, and they turn into monsters.
They do. They turn into monsters. They're not, they can't see beyond their own anger and their own, like, I have to be a man. I have to prove myself that way. And certain cultures are literally raised that way. Certain cultures, the men are always seen that they have to be the top dog.
But at the same time, I think these men, like, especially Bashar al-Assad or Putin, it's not about the culture, it's not about anything.
Bashar al-Assad for sure has a small dick, just saying.
I'm not arguing that. I'm saying there are some people that I believe are just kind of evil deep down. And once they have power, that their negative evilness just intensifies because they're unstoppable.
It's important to note how they were raised, though. Because if Bashar al-Assad was raised being like, guys, it doesn't even fucking matter. Like, we should just all be blessed that we're in charge of this country. That's not how he was raised, though. He was raised to believe he is the one. Like, he's the man who will run this country.
That is true, because
you could easily raise someone who's in charge to be a good person and not be an evil
100%,
piece of shit.
100%. But I'm saying I think some people have a tendency, once they have power, to go on power trips and lean the other direction.
I think having a good mother is always the key.
Yeah. Shout out
to moms.
Love
your child. Love your child. Treat them like the true king they are from a very young age.
But posturing made me think of, like, you know when, like, some guys, like, that are, like, super macho and, like, they say probably no homo when they're about to get into, like, a fight or a dance battle? They, they get in their face.
Dance battle?
Isn't that what happens in life? No, but they get, like, their foreheads are almost touching and, like, they look like they're about to kiss.
Yeah.
And then they, like, break dance or something.
It's kind of homoerotic.
Yeah, it's fucking, like, all those people just want to fuck each other.
Yeah, anyway, so.
And they're all coming from cultures that are very homophobic. So that's the answer. You guys could all have a fucking orgy. We've solved the Middle Eastern issue.
If Putin... No, I actually shouldn't do this.
No,
I'll never be
not today.
I will never be allowed in Iran again. I do want to end on this note. There was a really good op-ed in the New York Times written by two security advisors from Saudi Arabia and Iran who, in reality, if they did not have approval to write this, would be killed. But they go on to say that we write as citizens and foreign policy veterans of two countries that most Americans presume are locked in mortal combat, Iran and Saudi Arabia. In fact, after decades of proxy conflict and frozen ties between our countries, we now believe it is time to explore a new foundation for the lasting peace in our region. Neither of us are starry-eyed idealists. We are both hardened realists with distrust for one another, and that mistrust is shared at the top levels of our respective governments. At the same time, we have seen the destructive consequences of crises in which our countries side with one or another government or movement involved in a competition for power, for example, in Yemen, Syria, Lebanon, Bahrain, Iraq.
While we blame each other for this, while we blame the other side for this pattern, we agree that the net result has been costly, has eroded the confidence of the people our government serve, and has wasted incalculable resources and countless lives that should have been used to build a new Middle East rather than tear it down. The time for dialogue is now, because the situation's historic conflict zones are ripe for diplomacy. So I think that is fucking wild. I do agree that Iran and Saudi Arabia need to fucking figure it out and become friends and become allies and stop being allies with the, like, basically Saudi Arabia does not need to be allies with the U.S. Saudi Arabia needs to be allies with its own fucking people in the Middle East. And I agree with this. And this is a really fucking wild ass.
A lot of smart leaders in the Middle East, whether it was, who do we talk about from Egypt? Nasser or... like, smart leaders are always, their intention is to unite the Middle East. That's how you know that they're after, like, long-standing strength, is because they know our power in the Middle East, or our, like, culture strength, comes together, not divided. And since the fucking colonization of that fucking region, we've been divided as fuck, and we haven't recovered since. But real talk, I need to pee really bad.
That's fine. I'm done with my section.
Should we just sign off with our handles? And
yeah, let's do this. Shireen has to pee, so we're going to go.
I think I might have a UTI.
Disgusting.
Once you have it once, you're more likely to get it again. Always pee when you have to pee. I also should shit my pants this
week.
I'm
just kidding. There's nothing disgusting about having UTI. Honey, I have had the burniest ones. Not,
but it hurts
no
so
relation
bad.
To Bernie Sanders. Not now, my UTI but like has UTI. No relation to Bernie Sanders. But boy, did it burn.
Feel the burn.
I
okay,
felt
sorry.
That burn.
Okay, so find us at EthnicallyAmb, AMB on Twitter, EthnicallyAmbBig, AMB on Instagram. You can follow me at ShiroHero666 on Twitter and ShiroHero on Instagram. Anna?
Hosnier. I'm on Twitter at Anna Hosnier.
And
you know, keep up, EthnicallyAmbiguousPod.com. Yeah. Go look at our footnotes for more information. Maybe next week we won't talk about Iran, or maybe we'll all be dead because we all got bombed in an escalation. No big.
R.I.P. Also, if you listen to Behind the Bastards, our sister show that Sophie produces, I was on two episodes last week. They were really fun. I talked to Robert about the payloan industry, that's disgusting, and also Jacob Wall, also disgusting. So if you guys want to listen to me get angry for most of the episode, please tune in. It was a fun time, and I like that show a lot. So
yes.
Listen to that.
And tomorrow is my birthday, bitches. I'm turning 29, so feel free to Venmo me at Anna Hosnier. I have no shame. I need some money. It's a long story. I may have some of my money on a Ponzi scheme. No big deal.
She's crying. Okay. Talk to you later. Bye.
Are you gonna bite that ass?
Oh yeah, sure.
3 you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith, host of the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at the very least as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and I answer your phone calls and respond to your tweets. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions and straight-shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers, all that and more. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
The Elevation with Stephen Furtick podcast was created with you in mind. This is a podcast for those feeling discouraged or needing guidance from God. Together in this podcast, we'll dive deep into scripture, uncover the powerful truths that will help you rise above your limitations and embrace your full potential. We're here to equip you with the tools you need to conquer life's challenges. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.